Hello, everybody. Welcome to EverStage's Go to Masters podcast, Season 2. We interview go-to-market leaders from today's most dynamic companies. Their unique insights, hard-earned lessons, and innovative visions are the stories we bring to you weekly. For today's episode, we have Dan joining us. Dan is the VP of Revenue Operations at Signified. Welcome to the podcast, Dan. Can you please tell our listeners a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, thanks for having me on the podcast today, Mike. I had a chance to listen to a few of these Go to Masters podcast episodes on a few of my runs, and really honored to be the guest on today's episode. My name is Dan Zhao. I lead the revenue operations team here at Signified. And Signified is an e-commerce revenue optimization platform that helps some of the largest global retailers with growing their online sales fearlessly. So that includes protecting them from different types of fraud and abuse vectors, allowing them to increase their online sales. And every day, my team and I get the honor of working with a lot of our go-to-market teams from marketing, sales, and customer success with making their lives a little bit easier with improving processes and tools that they interact with. So everything from traditional marketing operations, sales operations, customer success operations, RevTech, which is essentially our go-to-market systems, reporting and analytics team, as well as commissions and enablement functions report up to my team. I'm sure we'll dig into a little bit more, but I'm a recovering salesperson. I've done everything from mid-market to enterprise sales from both the individual contributor and sales management side before I pivoted into a career in RevOps.
Oh, I love it, man. This is going to be great for our audience. I think you brought up a couple hot topics that I'm sure we'll dive into. And the first one certainly being, how'd you get into RevOps? I love this part of our podcast because most paths are non-traditional, right? As far as how you get into RevOps. And so, and I know, I believe you started as a chemical engineer, you know, early on in your career. So walk us through that journey.
Yeah, for sure, Mike. You're absolutely right. I feel like RevOps has become one of the fastest growing jobs that you see posted on LinkedIn. And there's not really a very traditional path at the moment to it, right? You see people from all walks of life, from like finance and like operations backgrounds moving into it, as well as like the go-to-market side. For me, I started off as an engineer, educated as a chemical engineer and university. Back then, I was, you know, first job out of college, I worked in the semiconductors industry in Portland, Oregon. My fiance at the time, now my wife, found a job up in the Seattle, Washington area, which is where I still am today. And I was at this crossroads very early on in my career, thinking about like, well, what do I want to do? Do I want to continue being an engineer and a scientist? Or do I want to, you know, maybe go back to getting my master's or PhD, or even going to the business side of things and just kind of exploring what was interesting in my career? I ended up going with the latter option and found myself at a company that did specialty chemicals distribution. So essentially, they sold chemicals on behalf of some of the major manufacturers like Dow and DuPont. And this was essentially my first foray into sales. I was an inside sales account manager, had a territory of about 300 accounts that I was in charge of maintaining, renewing, and upselling. And I gained a lot of my really important foundational sales skills in this job. So everything from how to do discovery to objection handling. And I leveraged these skills eventually to move into the tech industry, actually at a company that a friend of mine had recommended looking into. Company at the time was called White Pages, but it rebranded to Ekata. It's essentially a fraud prevention company that sold data APIs. Eventually was acquired by MasterCard in 2021. But Mike, I mentioned thinking about getting my master's or PhD at one point in chemical engineering. And I actually found that my 5 years at Ekata was almost like getting a bachelor's, MBA, and PhD in go-to-market. And I got my fulfillment of getting like an advanced degree, just so happened to be in go-to-market and sales. So I started off at Ekata as a mid-market account executive. My sales process there really evolved. You know, I used to do chemical sales, which was a lot more relationships and transactional. And this became a lot more consultative. And that helped me, I believe, be successful. Like I took a lot of my background as an engineer on how to optimize processes, how to follow a process. And that allowed me to be successful in exceeding my quota in my first year at Ekata. I got, you know, the fortunate promotion to enterprise sales. And that's where I helped Ekata enter in new markets. So we were traditionally, I was in North America and selling to e-commerce retailers. And this enterprise sales role was really focused on entering like the EMEA region, payments and financial services verticals. As an enterprise sales rep, frankly, I would tell everyone they should spend a short stint in sales at some point in their career, because I learned so much just on the business side. I learned
absolutely
how to plan for accounts, tailor prospecting, discovery, consultative solution selling, objection handling, navigating really complex organizations and building relationship maps, executive sponsorship, how to do proposals and negotiations, so much, right? Like I use a lot of these skills today, actually, in like a RevOps leadership role. And naturally, I leaned a lot towards the process-oriented side that I had as an engineer and some of the operational strengths I'd picked up as a sales rep to be successful in this enterprise sales role. After a few years doing enterprise sales at Ekata, I was tapped for a really exciting opportunity to go move to Singapore to open up that company's Asia Pacific office and build out and lead the sales team there. At this point, Ekata was acquired by MasterCard, been really successful in the APAC region after a couple of years there, set up all the operations, built up and exceeded our revenue goals. And my current boss here at Signified and actually previous mentor at Ekata, he tapped me on to take on a sales operations leadership role at Signified, which is where I've been. And honestly, I'm really thankful because he took a really big bet on me. I didn't really see myself as like an operations leader.
Yeah.
He had pointed out to me many of the skills I picked up throughout my career very much aligned to operations leadership, like how he was able to like bring people together cross-functionally for our Asia Pacific office between marketing, sales, partnerships, BD, and customer success. Really important skill for a RevOps professional to be able to do, right? Remove some of the silos, get people together, having them following a playbook that allows for sustainable growth. And since then, I've been at Signified since 2022. We built out the sales ops function here first, and we ultimately merged that with all of our go-to-market ops and systems teams. So that was marketing ops, sales ops, CS ops, and our CRM Salesforce team. And since then, Signified has been on this wonderful 1.5 year journey for RevOps. We've been able to break down a lot of silos, consolidate and streamline our tech stack, and run a lot of important strategic initiatives at ground to help Signify continue to mature, you know, in the market.
So, you know, ultimately, there's a lot of paths that I think folks get in when they get to RevOps and certainly become, you know, VPs of RevOps, but they all end up, I think, with similar experiences, right? So, you know, you're talking about how you obviously had to be very process oriented to become an engineer to begin with. Then as you become a sales rep, some sales reps kind of really tap into that process orientation, but some don't, for sure, right? But when you have the hybrid of both, as well as the experience of opening a new office, opening a new region, everything that really comes with that, you've obviously moved up stack from, you know, your entry level sales role up into an enterprise role. You really start to get all these certain experiences about what it really takes to run a successful go-to-market initiative. And then you can translate that, right? And I really love how, you know, you kind of, you know, went the path from engineer to sales to, you know, essentially RevOps, because I certainly think there's a need from a CRO perspective in the future where I think folks like yourself, that actually makes a lot more sense than maybe like your VP of global sales turning into to your RevOps or your CRO leader, right? You know, you've had such different experiences that I think it actually kind of maybe more preps you more arguably to be the CRO versus somebody who's just, you know, hunting and gathering, right? As well as I think, you know, one of the things I definitely want to double click into is just building sales strategies and sales teams from scratch, right? You obviously had to do that in different markets. So I guess at a high level, like, what does your process look like? Like, how do you understand key investments, you know, headcount planning, tech stack, or whatever ultimately kind of comes to your head about your process and building these things out?
Yeah, no, for sure, Mike. And I love the comments you made about having more of a multifaceted background. Traditionally, the CRO role has always been filled by like the VP of global sales or SVP of global sales before they get promoted into that role. But like oftentimes CROs are tasked with more than just new logo acquisition. They're in charge of like net retention and they're in charge of like the whole customer journey, right? So usually having someone who's got a lot more exposure than just like new business sales is really important. And yeah, I think you're right. You'll see a lot more CROs that have more like multifaceted backgrounds in that regard. I love the, you know, question you asked there about, you know, building sales strategies and what are all the considerations into doing so. And, you know, even, you know, somebody who's been a salesperson and also been a RevOps professional, I think the process always starts in the same spot. I think it always starts with understanding your ideal customer profile or ICP and your total addressable market or TAM. I think that's critical. So you have to really understand product market fit. You have to really define a clear ICP and what accounts you're going to go after and which ones you're not going to go after. And really ask yourself, like, where do I have the right to win? Then you're able to take that a step further and look at your ICP TAM and start to categorize and segment them by different things. Most companies do like company size, what vertical or industry, the geography that those accounts are based in, or even a combination of those verticals, right? Like here at Signified, we have six segments that we do across a number of factors from the company's sizing as well as their geographic location. And then this is how you really form a successful sales strategy with picking the right accounts and putting them into targeted territories, which I think, you know, successful sales strategy doesn't mean just having territories that like an AE goes after. You have to make sure that your strategy also involves cross-functional resources like your marketing team. How are they going to handle ABM, like digital demand generation plus like field events to help generate awareness and demand for? I think selling more than ever is like team-based, and it's not just the AE trying to do all the outbounding and conversion of prospects and leads into deals, but BDRs are supposed to help there too. Partnerships, right? Like if you guys have a partner motion that helps with referrals or integrations to make the sales process or sales cycle more smooth for your customer. So you need all of those like resources deployed against those territories and those accounts. And then from there, you can do other things like prioritize the buying personas into each of those accounts. And then, you know, you mentioned also like, what are your investments you want to make? I'll talk about two of them. One is like investments in headcount. And the second is just investments in tech stack. So for headcount planning, I think it comes from, you know, usually like a top-down approach, but more and more I see people marrying top-down with bottoms-up. So top-down is usually where your finance and your board of directors comes together and they're talking like, okay, we need to grow like, you know, top-line revenue and EBITDA by X percent. Usually there's some goals that get set. Someone gets like a CRO gets assigned in and you have to like trickle everything down. What I've seen is typical best practices is you want some wiggle room. So you have to ensure that the amount of quotas that you've deployed to your quota-carrying headcount, like AEs, you can get to a place where, let's say 70 to 80% is your average quota attainment. You need to be in a place where if you get that as your average quota attainment, that you have enough spread to cover the goal that you've set with the board of directors. But even more important than that, frankly, is I think more people are starting to realize there's more nuance in that. You'll need to marry this with the bottoms up approach, which to me, it means really looking at how reasonable your quotas are per rep. Do they have enough accounts? How many of those accounts can actually be converted into qualified pipeline? And then from there, like how much of that pipeline is going to be converted into bookings? So the other thing people are starting to look more at is just like a coverage model from like an how much open pipe do you have coming into the year against what your, you know, near-term quoted targets are in H1? How many deals can a rep feasibly work? So starting to think about like the frontline manager, like managing a group of AEs, like how many, you know, deals can someone actually run in parallel to each other without dropping the ball on some of these, right? You know, Mike, I don't really think there's an exact science to all this. Otherwise, everyone would just be copying the playbook. But you have some sense of like practicality and knowing like what actually matters. And then that usually is what goes into your proper headcount, quota, and capacity planning. The second part I'll talk to you about, Mike, is just from a RevOps perspective, you have to kind of make decisions on your tech stack based off your sales strategy. So, you know, for us, I think it really comes down to what your sales motion looks like, right? If you have an SMB high velocity motion, you might want to invest in sales engagement platforms or SEPs like Outreach or Salesloft first. That might be important because you need to get to scale at hitting up all the, you know, hundreds of accounts that a rep might be covering. You might also want like conversation intelligence or CI tools in your toolkit because the frontline manager might not have enough bandwidth to manage like 6-7 reps and be on all their calls. If you have an enterprise selling motion or enterprise sales selling motion, long sales cycle, big deals, you might want to invest more into like account planning and relationship mapping software or even project management functionality in your go-to-market stack because you're going to have to coordinate sales, product, customer success, legal, finance, all these different teams that help with winning a deal, especially if it's a more complex deal cycle. And then lastly, I'll say like we always invest in this at every company I've been at, which is like firmographic, technographic, and intent-based third-party data enrichment providers. So you need that for like account intelligence. You need that for account prioritization as well as for lead routing. So those are some of the like ZoomInfo and competitors out there that help enrich your, you know, account stack.
So, but I kind of want to, you know, pinpoint the top down, bottom up approach because ultimately when you were explaining kind of how you think about, you know, the firmographics, the technographics, the personas, the territory mapping, if you don't have a foundational knowledge and you're not actively doing that research and consistently doing that research and feeding that up to the board to let the board then make the decisions about what headcount needs to be and what TAM actually looks like and things like that, then you're going to actually be disconnected. And that's how that happens, right? And so it's that bottom up approach has multiple levels even within it. You know what I mean? Where it's like, what's feeding the ultimate decision? It really has to be cohesive. And I think you obviously, I think, have given a lot of really good insight into what are some of the data points and the metrics that you're looking at that people, I'm sure some of our audience will open their minds and be like, "Bleh, didn't think about that one." And that's obviously really, really big, really, really important, especially related to our sales cycle and our sales motion, right? You know, you mentioned, yeah, you know, BDRs and getting into a market in a region where you need to drum up the intent. The intent's not naturally there, right? And so how do you go about doing that? That's a really long game a lot of times in order to be able to hit, you know, revenue targets, and it doesn't have a real immediate impact, you know? And so if you don't know who you're going after, how you're going to go after them, how can you expect headcount to be accurate? You know what I mean? How can you expect quotas to be accurate where you're hitting 70 to 80% of quota, you know, for the majority of people, right? And so, yeah, I think it's really, really important how it all kind of works together.
For sure.
Yeah. And so a little kind of segue, because obviously I think your answer itself gives the, you know, some of the answer to this next question. But, you know, obviously you've built out sales teams, right? So you've not only brought in, you know, a group of new hires, but you've also helped them consistently overachieve quotas. And so I'd love to get a sense of what's your playbook for finding new talent, new sales rep talent, and then also kind of what does ramp look like in a perfect world?
Yeah, no, for sure. You're taking me back to my sales management days, Mike. So I typically look for three things in a good sales rep. I think number one is intellectual curiosity, especially if they're selling like B2B technology software. You need to just be intellectually curious. And what that usually translates into is a rep who wants to understand the details of the business and the tech stack of their prospect and customer, so much so that they can draw like a workflow of it and that they can kind of picture themselves working at that, their prospect's organization. So I think intellectual curiosity is really key. That translates into being very good at discovery, translates to being able to bring business value and consultation to the client that adds more value than the typical sales rep. And then I think the second thing a sales rep really needs when you're looking for hiring for one is passion, hunger, and ambition. So what that really means is these are some of the intangibles that are really hard to teach. Sometimes you either have it or you don't. It just varies based off, you know, as long as if you're a sales rep looking for a role that you find the right company and product or offering that you're really excited about, that usually comes naturally with it. Like you're passionate about it. You read about the industry that that company is in, and you just know all the trends happening. That's the passion and ambition coming through. And hunger is just natural. Like they just need to come every day not feeling satisfied with where they're at and wanting to continue to deliver more in their role. So I always look for that, and looking for like what they're passionate about outside of work is a good indicator to see like how much they can show in their work, you know, their day job as well. And I think the third thing I usually look for in like a good new sales hire is like critical thinking and problem solving. This is pretty connected to that first attribute I mentioned, Mike, which is intellectual curiosity. But if you find a rep who is just really good at thinking through complex business problems, they can be a good sales rep, because really what people are buying is not software. They're buying solutions to problems. And if you have a sales rep who can translate solutions to solve business problems because they think, well, critically, then you have a good sales rep at that point. As for your question about ramp up process, I'm a really big fan. I've used this both as a RevOps leader as well as a sales leader in 30, 60, 90 day onboarding plans. I just posted about this on LinkedIn about a few weeks ago. Usually you want a really crisp like template that allows sales representatives to know like, hey, what are the expectations I need to hit from an outcomes and knowledge and competency standpoint by my first 30 days on the job? What about 60 days? And then finally 90 days as you're kind of finishing the first quarter on the job. I think what's really important is in that template, I usually outline that you have like a weekly learning objective that the sales rep needs to know. Like for example, like by week three, you should be able to do like an elevator pitch the product to like a technical stakeholder. And you might also need to know about the partner ecosystem. And then I would also say an important part of onboarding is certification. You know, you get what you inspect is something that a previous CEO of mine told me. And what that really means is just being able to sit down with the sales rep, certifying them on key skills and competencies that they should know. And that helps you identify proactively any gaps in those competencies or knowledge that you'll need to train them up on. So I think that's important, 30, 60, 90 day framework. And you know, ideally it's easy to onboard a new sales hire though, if you bring on the rep with the right attributes that I mentioned.
Yeah, no, 100%. But I also think too, it is, if you're hiring A players and have a B process, you still can luck out and get a producer, right? But if you hire B, C players and don't have an A process, you're really just hoping for a miracle, right? And so what kind of sticks out to me is certainly one from like a sales skills perspective, and just certainly like hustle and grit and intellectual curiosity, I think is all very, very important. What I also like to look at in that instance is how is their ability to tie back the information that I'm sharing with them during an interview process? How does that actually translate? Because you can be intellectually curious, but if I'm not actually leveraging what I'm intellectually curious about in my sales pitch or in my storytelling, I think you could argue as well, is that actually going to translate? And it happens naturally when you're interviewing somebody, right? You know, you're asking them questions. They're asking you questions. You're giving them answers. Are they leveraging your answers in other contexts that they are sharing, right? I think that's, you know, I think a combination, kind of an execution that at least I personally, you know, look at.
Yeah.
And then your 30-60-90 plan, I think one is tremendous, but what really sticks out to me, I think a lot of companies have a 30-60-90 plan, is just how thoughtful you are with what are the tangible asks that are going to be of your individual and of your team member, regardless of what role they're in, at these milestones, right? If you don't set the right expectations and enable your people to be able to hit those milestones, don't be surprised if they don't, right? It's on, you know, I'm a big extreme ownership guy, right? So at the end of the day, it's always on the leader. And did we actually set this up in the right way? But certainly you hire A players, they can cover up some of your own flaws, and you should be looking for that. You know, I think a lot of people would argue.
Absolutely. No, I like what you said there about being able to tie information that you give them back to something, right? Like there's a lot of sales reps who have like a script that they follow, especially on that first call, and they ask like discovery question. And when you give them really valuable information, they're not really like playing off of that, right? They could be asking secondary or third follow-up questions, but they don't always do that, right? And you want the rep who can kind of dig deeper and ask that second or third order question.
Absolutely. Like, you know, when I ramp, obviously I'm a sales leader. And so when I ramp folks, it's really on that like 60, 90 days, I'm digging more into, do you genuinely understand the why behind the question and the feature and whatever that use case is? Because once you actually understand it, that will allow you to actually go deeper, right? If you don't, then you're just asking questions, ask questions, you know?
Absolutely.
But yeah, so kind of giving it back to RevOps for sure. So, you know, so as a VP of RevOps, you know, what are some measures that you're taking to ensure cross-functional collaboration, which I think is so, so vitally important across your entire organization? You mentioned there's, you know, RevOps and marketing ops and sales ops. And I think a lot of companies are like that. But even outside of just like your traditional go-to-market, you know, how do you bring, you know, different functions together in order with the ultimate goal of driving revenue growth?
Yeah, I love that question, Mike. One of the strengths that I think every RevOps leader and RevOps professional should have is being an activator, somebody who can bring people together. My boss would say that RevOps is really the glue of the go-to-market organization, which is like bringing people together, making sure that they don't work in silos. And one of the ways that, you know, we do it here at Signify, you know, as a VP of RevOps, we use objectives, key results, like OKRs as a framework. That really helps us with prioritizing projects, allows us to properly goal set. And it really helps us immensely with cross-functional alignment and collaboration. We also have an operating calendar where we have recurring syncs with all of our key cross-functional stakeholders across marketing, sales, customer success, finance, legal, HR, you name it. This is naturally allowing us to get on like a habit or a rhythm with all of our customers and stakeholders internally at the company to ensure that we're always getting feedback on any processes, programs, policies, or tools that we've released to them. It also just ensures that we're on that cadence, right? Like if you want to get, you know, fit, you need to continue to exercise and continue to exercise by setting clear times that you're going to go to the gym and you're not going to skip that, right? Same way, if you want to get good at cross-functional alignment and serving your customers as a RevOps professional, you need to have a cadence with them and you can't skip it, right? So I think that's really critical. One of the things we also do here that I think has been really helpful in the last year and a half that we've implemented is, you know, I mentioned OKRs. As part of each OKR that we do quarterly here as a RevOps team, we have to have a project plan. And the project plan is as simple as it sounds, like a document that we write that writes out what the problem statement that the project is looking to solve, the impact we're hoping the project's going to make, and then scoping out things like, what's the goal of the project? Like, what are the 3 to 4 goals we need to get done? What are our non-goals? I think that's equally as important as goals, which is what is out of scope. Like, yes, this might be something important to do, but we're not going to prioritize it, at least for this iteration of the project. And then you have to like outline your stakeholders and deliverables. Outlining the stakeholders is really important because that allows you to think cross-functionally, like, hey, I normally don't bring the finance team for this type of revenue reconciliation project, but I probably should, because this will impact them if we don't tell them about how we're instrumenting the measurement here. So there's a lot of like examples I'd give, but like, I think if you just start with the planning phase and involving people early, and you have the tools to involve them early, then, you know, you should be able to foster cross-functional collaboration, which should in turn lead to sustainable revenue growth.
Oh my gosh. Like, what you're saying is making so much sense. And I think it makes a lot of folks that even maybe have those, you know, we'll call them quarterly, you know, executive discussions where you're talking about strategy without a project plan, without outlining clear goals. Who are the what's the team that actually needs to be involved with this outside of just this executive layer, which you didn't really bring up, but I'm sure you probably are doing, yeah. Or you need to leverage other members of your team at other layers to ultimately get a full breadth of what this project needs to be. And also, like, what's the outcome we're not trying to do, right? If you don't have those clear goals on what is the end result, a lot of times I see this all the time where it's like, we're collecting data to do what, right? We're collecting insight and we're, you know, we're spinning our wheels to do what? And I think a lot of times without that sort of process, one, that ends up just to be an executive meeting that doesn't actually close the loop ever, right? But two, it also spirals out of control to where you never actually meet your endpoint, which just wasted everybody's time. So it's the opposite, actually. Does the opposite of fostering cross collaboration. And so, you know, wow, that's really, really great. I'm sure our audience is going to love that. So next one, and I can't wait for this one. So what would be the list of the top 3 skills you'd recommend to someone who wants to, you know, venture into the growing field of RevOps?
Yeah, that's a good question. We listed out like some of the top attributes I've looked for before in like sales professionals. In terms of RevOps professionals, funnily enough, the skills are not super different, but there's like some more like specific skill sets I definitely would recommend for people to pick up if they're looking to make a career pivot into RevOps. Like, I'll use the rule of 3 here. Like, the top 3 skills I would look for is, you know, number 1, communication and like soft skills. So primarily like verbal and written communication skills, cross-functional collaboration, ability to persuade executive committees. Like, I think that's really key, right? Oftentimes you're spending a lot of your time as a RevOps professional trying to get people aligned, getting them agree on like a consistent process that works end-to-end, data collection that is very seamless between systems and tools. And you have to be able to communicate really well. The other thing too is like why communication matters in a RevOps role is everyone you're serving is incredibly busy with a key performance indicator that they have to focus on. If you're working with sales teams, like they're constantly heads down trying to hit a bookings target. Marketing is trying to maybe hit a pipeline target. Customer success is trying to hit a renewals or net retention rate target. So you have to be really clear with like what project you're working on and what impact it makes to them. I like what you mentioned earlier, Mike, about how, hey, I need to understand like, why are we doing this thing? Like, for what purpose, right? And that is what a good RevOps professional needs to bring to the table. They need to be able to explain the why and the purpose and the impact. I think the second thing that every good RevOps professional should be strong at is process optimization skills. So they need to be able to take anything and make it a process, and then find the bottlenecks and inefficiencies. It's really key for them to be able to understand things in a process lens, because that's, you know, their role is to help the company scale and do it sustainably. So if you can take anything from like, how does a lead come in and get worked by a BDR or AE, and you can kind of do a process flow diagram. And for those of you who are engineers, you might be familiar with that concept of like, what's box 1, and like, okay, it hits the form. And then after that, it needs to go through your marketing automation tool. And then it hits and integrates with your CRM. And then it gets lead scored. And then it gets routed through lean data or whatever automation tool you have there. Like, I look for reps that can describe a process and diagram that process, because I think that is everything that trickles down into being a good RevOps professional that delivers value. And then I think finally, the third skill I'd look for, Mike, in a RevOps professional would just be second order critical thinking and analytical skills. This is really similar to the thing I mentioned for sales reps I look for, right? anyone who is very thoughtful and analytical can work well with data. They can draw insights from it. They know how to draw insights that can be taken a step further and have action taken on it. So I look for people who are just really critical thinkers. They can solve problems and they don't look for the easy surface level answer, but they look a little bit deeper than that. And I think that's usually a good RevOps professional that can bring strategic value to a company.
No, I love it, man. I think RevOps professionals, you know, again, I think they come from a lot of different walks of life. I think they come, you know, with a lot of different experiences. But I think what you just outlined are the commonalities amongst really good ones. And I'll simplify it from the standpoint of they are glue, one, to the entire organization, right? They're doing a lot of things that maybe people don't understand how important they are, but that's how they're getting done. But it's also, you're tying people together, right? So you're tying the business together on one sense, but you're tying people together, cross-functional departments, getting people motivated for what's in it for them in order to, you know, drive towards a greater business objective, right? But also there's the whole technology side of this too, right? And process mapping in general, right? Not just your tech stack, but also like how you're developing processes internally at your organization. You have to tie all these things together. What's the why behind step one, step two? What's the why behind technology one and technology two? And how can they work together to generate insights? You're the glue, right? You're a lot of times, and hopefully if we're doing any of a good job with this podcast, it's not the unsung hero anymore, but a lot of times it's the unsung hero of the whole organization, certainly the go-to-market. And so I think it's really, really important. Anything, you have to naturally want to do those things, right? And find personal satisfaction in those things, I think is also super important, or else you're just going to get really frustrated really quick. But, you know, I know obviously, you know, you have a busy schedule. So how do you take a step back, unwind, recharge? Do you have any, you know, favorite hobbies or guilty pleasures you indulge with?
Yeah, I'm a pretty competitive person. So I've always I grew up playing tennis, and lately I've got older. So I've been really into pickleball the last couple of years. So I play pickleball with friends and family. I like going on runs. I'm not a great runner, but I picked it up as a 2024 resolution to be better at running and just build up some stamina. But besides that, I just like doing a lot of the simple things in life, like traveling, playing board games with friends. So that's usually how I unwind. So combination of pickleball with some, you know, leisure activities with friends.
Yeah. You know, I find for a lot of folks that are naturally really, really, you know, good at their job, obviously you have to be all in, and those guilty pleasures that you have really have to force your mind to go somewhere else, right? Pickleball, for example, playing a sport, you can't really be thinking about, you know, hey, is that territory I set up, is that actually, you know, the best one for our company? If, you know, I'm trying to get a point, you know, you can do it while you run though. And I think you brought
that's
up.
That's true. Yeah. That's why you got to have two types of hobbies. Yeah. One where you can kind of like focus on something else, and one where you can kind of let your mind wander. Yeah.
No, totally. Because I think the other side of the two, I mean, I'm very similar. I like to play basketball, but I also am a Peloton guy. So I'm riding the bike. And I think the creative thinking that naturally your mind kind of goes to work as an escape from, oh my gosh, this bike ride is super hard, or this run is super hard, I think also has benefit, as well as it kind of can get your creative juices flowing about a particular problem, just getting separated from being at your office or being staring at your computer, right? So I love it. I really appreciate that. And I also really appreciate the, you know, the time. I know, you know, we've obviously hit, you know, 30, 35 minutes pretty quick here. So I certainly have some closing questions for you. So are there any specific resources or books you recommend for someone as they're, you know, looking to scale their career in RevOps?
Yeah, there's a few. So if you're looking for a book to improve like your communication skills, I like Radical Candor by Kim Scott and Fierce Conversations by Susan Scott. So essentially, the Scott women have some good books on improving your communication skills and style. Another book that I read recently that I really enjoyed was Managing Transitions by William Bridges. RevOps is always kind of in charge of spearheading change and change management at companies. And I think this is a really good book to describe like how you can take an organization that is going through a really massive change to have it happen in a way that the transition is, you know, palatable for your constituents and stakeholders. So those are three books that I would recommend to anyone looking to be up-level their RevOps game.
I love it. I love it. I think all those things are obviously topics that we've already discussed, you know, today too. So I think it's really relevant. Any final thoughts, words of wisdom to our listeners?
Yeah. I'll kind of repeat the kind of theme that we talked about, Mike, which is RevOps is meant to be the glue of an organization. To do it well, continue to stay intellectually curious and humble, always seek to learn and improve yourself. I also think it's really valuable for RevOps professionals to come in with a positive solution-seeking mindset. So it can always be hard because RevOps is always in charge of finding some of the operators day to day. But if you go in with a really positive mindset and like what you said, Mike, like somebody who's just really happy and excited to do the work, I think that goes a long way to being successful as a RevOps professional and eventually a RevOps leader. And finally, my advice to everyone on the podcast is, you know, be willing to say no in the appropriate way and prioritizing your energy towards strategic initiatives. Of course, you got to keep the lights on, but oftentimes we can catch ourselves doing too much of that work and you lose out on some of the high value impact that you're able to bring as a RevOps professional. So be strategic about how you say no and how you're able to prioritize projects.
Well, I think that part of it, that last part that you brought up, is why I found so much value when you were talking about, you know, the OKRs that you and your team kind of look at to make sure cross-functionally you're operating. If you don't have the process in place to attack each project with desired outcomes and what are not the desired outcomes, are you going to be able to strategically say no, right? Everybody's going to have a problem. Everybody's going to have that fire. But if you have to be really, really specific with what your goals are and what you're going to ultimately say no to, right? I think all those things are really starting to tie together. It's just awesome, man. So last question is, where can our audience connect with you and learn more?
Yeah. Folks can find me on LinkedIn. You can search my name, Dan Jiao, and Jiao is spelled J-I-A-O. But yeah, that's usually where I sometimes post, not too often, but LinkedIn is probably the easiest place for folks to connect. I'm most happy to chat RevOps or anything else go to market.
Awesome, man. Well, I can guarantee for anybody listening to this, reach out to him. There's so much more that is behind, you know, these answers that Dan was giving. And so I really appreciate you, Dan. Really appreciate the time.
Appreciate you having me on the podcast today, Mike.
Awesome. Awesome. Thanks. Well, that brings us to the end of another insightful episode of Go to Masters. You know, big thanks to Dan for sharing his experiences and valuable insights. Remember, you guys can turn in every week to learn more from the game changers driving hyper growth companies across the globe. Go to Masters is brought to you by Everstage, your trusted partner for transforming the way businesses handle sales compensation. And I'm your host, Mike, signing off. Thanks, everybody.